This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today, we learn about the trash issues on Kauai as part of our series, Trashing the Islands. HPR's Ku'uwehi Hiraishi joins us this morning to talk about her deep dive into the Garden Isles Opala.
Good morning, Catherine. Kauai County is on a really tight timeline right now. If you look at their landfill, they just have gone through an expansion of the landfill, which will give them another 7 years. And so that's a tight timeline when you think of the landfill business, because it'll probably take another 8 to 10 years to actually site a new landfill, if that's where they're going to go. So right now, the game plan is a potential site closer to town. So the landfill right now, the only landfill on Kauai, is out on the west side in Kekaha, right? So Waimea area. They are looking right now, the county is a new landfill site closer to town in Hanamaulu, which is sort of near the airport. And the price tag on that, which is what worries Mayor Derek Kawakami, is estimated right now to be as much as $100 million.
Ouch.
And a bulk of that is for the road that will, you know, take folks to this landfill. So they are potentially looking at another site. They don't know where yet, but another site for the landfill would be another option. The last option is possibly reopening the first phase of Kekaha landfill. So they're doing a mining study right now to see what materials are in there that could possibly be taken out that, you know, now we can recycle, or now we know how to dispose of, for example, cars. Take those out. Maybe we can have another as much as, I think, 30 years more if we reopen that first site.
No, I've been to that landfill, but that was many years ago. But I imagine, yeah, there's a lot underneath there.
Exactly. And figuring out, you know, I think this is what all counties are grappling right now. Figuring out what to do when your first landfill fills up is something that Kauai is definitely dealing with. But space on that small rural island is sort of their biggest challenge.
And the issue with the airports, I know, because with Ryan Finnerty's story, the concern that Hilo had. Well, you're from Hilo, you know about that with the bird strikes.
Yes, and that was the same that came up during conversations with Kauai County and that airport as well. And, you know, it's figuring out how to work with all these entities to make something like this happen is going to take a lot of time, but also a lot of money. And so right now, but it's, I think the biggest challenge for Kauai County, from what I've heard in interviews, is just finding space for everything, for the trash, for any programs you want to divert that trash from the landfill. So I got to speak to Allison Fraley, Solid Waste Management Program Coordinator for Kauai County, about that challenge of space.
Well, infrastructure is a challenge for us because we're so small. We generate such a small amount of waste compared to any place else that, you know, you just don't have that much stuff running through a facility. We don't have a lot of competition for certain processes, because it's just a one company job, you know. So things like that, the fact that we're small is a challenge for us.
All right, so one company job, speaking of that, most recently, what's kind of complicating matters for the county of Kauai was that their landfill operator, the contract negotiations with Waste Management of Hawaii, who had operated the landfill for many years, those contract negotiations broke down late last year. And so the county actually took over operation of the landfill, which is another cost, out in Kekaha. And that started in December. So they're a county in transition right now when it comes to waste management.
Yeah, and that whole issue of privatization has a long history, I think, as we saw on the Big Island, where that became an issue for, I think it was UPW at the time. So, yeah, it's complicated.
It is, and I think focusing on the front end is what I hear from a lot of county officials, but also folks out in the community, is figuring out how to divert waste away from the landfill. So on Kauai, they've got about a 43% diversion rate, meaning 43% of the waste that they do produce on island actually gets diverted and not put in the landfill at all through recycling programs, reuse programs, and whatnot. And one program that's been especially big for Kauai is their home composting program. So this is going on for nearly 20 years. Here's Fraley and recycling program coordinator for Kauai County, Keola Aki, talking about this program.
We've been distributing free backyard composting bins to residents for the last 17 years. When we say free, people do get excited.
Yeah, we give out a whole bunch every month. We distribute about 30 a month, and it comes out to less than $5 per ton for processing, which is the cheapest or most cost-effective program we have on INN.
Because we just have the one-time purchase of the unit, and people just take, instead of putting it, you know, at the curb or us paying contractors to manage the material, it's managed in everybody's backyard.
I stayed with a friend of mine up in Wailua Homestead. He had one in his backyard. So it's just this sort of like R2-D2 looking device. You put the, it's called an earth machine. You put the waste in up top. You can put green waste, paper, newspaper, all of your food for the most part up at the top. And then at the end of several months, you'll get soil that you can use for your garden. And so I've heard a lot of good things about how residents like this program. It's also free, which is nice. So every Friday you can go to the Ahukini Recycling Center there and pick one up. It's as easy as that. And convenience is huge when you're thinking about how to help people get waste away from the landfill, right? So food waste doesn't account for a lot on Kauai. It's about 10% of the waste stream. But here on Oahu, it's 20%.
Right. But it's interesting when you think about, what's your footprint and how do you reduce it?
Exactly. I had Allison actually Fraley gave me this exercise to do while I was there, where I take all my trash from my day that I generate and put it in a bag and carry it with me. And just the idea of knowing that this trash doesn't go away, that somebody's going to have to deal with it. I feel like it's good, when you throw things away, I've done my job, it's in a trash can. But when I had to carry it around, I tell you, going to Starbucks while I was on Kauai was generating too much trash for my bag.
Interesting. I never thought about that. I wonder if that's somehow a virtual reality thing, or if you could see everybody's trash.
Exactly. That's exactly right. I just moved out of my house and took my sister with me to dump all my things in the landfill, and she got to see the Kauai Lagoon landfill, and she was a little bit like, okay, maybe I should do something about it. And it's those little changes, those conversations on Kauai is so small too, that when they have these conversations, you still feel like you have this sort of sense of kuleana to do it.
Yeah, the personal responsibility.
Exactly, but it all can't be done by personal responsibility. One thing that I've learned from Kauai County was the producer responsibility laws that are in place for e-waste were actually very effective, this change. And so in speaking with Allison Fraley, she was saying that they have this program where the manufacturers of electronics actually pay into a program, a state program, that allows these counties or these counties to handle the waste. So here she is talking about that change.
We'd pay so much money for someone to take it as if it were hazardous waste, because there was no producer responsibility. The manufacturers didn't have to pay into the program or pay the state. They weren't regulated anything. And so the county just ended up having to deal with this stuff because we knew it was bad and it shouldn't go to landfill. But now that there's a law in place that requires the manufacturers to have programs available to the consumers, that now we have a grant-funded program, we have a recycler that's taking it 6 days a week. This is what we need for every kind of waste.
That's right. So there is emerging legislation nationwide and things like mattresses, carpets, paint, things that counties, when it gets to that end stream, can't really deal with. And so figuring out if the manufacturers can take care of things on the front end.
Right. And I know one issue is the solar panels. Oh, and what I learned this year, last year, was the wind turbines.
Where are you going to put it?
Exactly. And then the other thing I had in my mind, too, is surfboards.
Oh, yeah.
Lots to think about. All right. Thanks so much, Kuvehi.
Mahalo.
That was HPR's Kuvehi Hirishi wrapping up the week with our closer look at trash across our state.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
It's been an eventful week for astronomy in Hawaii. The Hawaii Convention Center hosted the largest ever gathering of the American Astronomical Society. Over 3,000 astronomers and researchers came together to present their work and to celebrate the field. Up in the stars, however, another meeting took place. 11-time world champion surfer Kelly Slater was in Hawaii today to host a chat with astronaut Christina Koch as she orbited the planet over 250 miles above the Earth's surface in the International Space Station. Together, they talk rocket launches, microgravity, and yes, surfing. Here are some of the highlights from their spacefaring talk story.
Kelly Slater, this is Mission Control Houston. Please call station for a voice check.
Station, this is Kelly Slater. How do you hear me?
Hi, Kelly. The International Space Station has you loud and clear. Welcome aboard.
All right. Thank you. First question I'm going to ask you is from two of my friends, my young little friends here in Hawaii. One wants to know how long the wait list is to get up to the space station. And this is from Toa. And Tama wanted to know if there's trash floating around in space. They are 7 and 10 years old.
Those are some great questions. I think you said the first one was how long is the wait list? Well, it is pretty long, but it is, you know, something that I think everyone has a shot at. Being an astronaut is an awesome career, and I never personally thought that I would be lucky enough to be here. It has been something I've wanted to do my entire life, and I was fortunate enough to be able to do it. The things I'm passionate about actually led me to a path that led me here eventually. So I think the waiting list is as long, you know, is as short as your dreams are big, really, because anybody, I think, that puts their mind to it could be here. And I think the opportunities are going to keep growing. So that's also exciting. In terms of trash, I think maybe they mean the trash that could be out in space, like space debris. And yes, that actually is something that we deal with here on board the space station, because if we collide with something, even if it's really small, because we're going 17,500 miles per hour, it can actually cause a lot of damage.
A little friend of mine, Sagan, wants to ask if you're proud to be a woman astronaut and inspire young girls like herself.
You know, that is a huge honor and part of my job. And I think one of the times that that stood out the most was when me and my crewmate Jessica got to do the first ever spacewalk that was just two women outside the space station. And knowing that so many people were following along and so many people were supporting us and telling their daughters about it, that was really special. So to me, it is absolutely a huge aspect of my job that I consider an honor, and I feel very lucky.
Someone wrote me a message and said they went to school with you, and he lives on the Big Island now, and he wanted you to get a picture of the Big Island for him.
That's funny. I have tons of pictures of the Big Island. Taking pictures of Hawaii is one of my favorite things to take pictures of, and I always make sure that I get out the best lens to do that. So tons of pictures of the Big Island. The Big Island is also where there's a NOAA base that is part of a kind of global monitoring division site of a network of sites that I used to work for, so I made sure to snap pictures of that.
I'm in Hawaii now, so any Hawaii pics will be cool, and I also have, I believe, some of the kids at Sunset Beach School across the street are watching us listen to the interview now. Explain to people about how you're not exactly in total zero gravity. You explain to me how you're falling around the Earth in orbit.
Yes, that's right. It feels like free fall, or it is free fall, which kind of feels like zero gravity, but it's really just because everything, all of us, the station and everything around, is actually just floating or falling around the Earth at the same rate in orbit. So what that means is, yeah, we can actually move around pretty much anywhere, and I don't feel any differently standing upside down or right side up, because we're all sort of falling the same. So we don't call it zero gravity, because anything that creates mass or any disturbances in that kind of perfect free fall mean that we have some effects of gravity or microgravity. So I think that's why you hear it called microgravity. Another way to think about it, I tell people, it's if you can imagine throwing something so hard and so fast that as it falls down, the Earth actually curves away from it. That's kind of what it's like being in orbit, and that's why you need the rocket to sort of get you up here.
A couple quick surf questions. How did you get into surfing? And obviously, are you missing it while being up there?
I do miss it a ton. In fact, I think that's, you know, aside from seeing my family and friends, getting back into that is one of the things I'm looking forward to the most. And at the very least, just getting back to the beach. I do live at the beach in Galveston, Texas. So taking a walk on the beach is going to be kind of the top of my list when I'm back. And I got into surfing actually through my husband. I met my husband in American Samoa, where I was working, as I mentioned, on a remote climate station for NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And, you know, he's a hardcore surfer, and he had taken a job in Samoa as well. And, you know, partially for work, but maybe surfing had a little bit more to do with it. So since then, you know, we've been surfing and taking surf trips all over the place. And of course, we surf in Galveston together. So I've always been a water person. I went to the beach. I grew up in coastal North Carolina. I basically lived at the beach in the summers, and I was a big sailor and, you know, did stand up paddle boarding and things like that. So getting into surfing was kind of a natural progression, and it was a way to really kind of embrace the outdoors in Galveston.
I think since we've been talking, you've gone about 5,000 miles, which is pretty wild. That's across the U.S. and back. What's it like taking off in a rocket and also re-entering the atmosphere? Which one is more exciting or scary, people want to know?
You know, I am a rookie flyer, so I have not experienced re-entering yet, but hopefully in just under a month, I will get to tell you about that too. But I can talk about launching on a rocket, and it was the most incredible experience I have ever had. It's funny because the simulators that we train in make you very comfortable with the launch sequence and all of the hours of activities that you have to do to get ready for that. So everything felt really normal. And then there is an actual countdown. You hear it going off, and you know, instead of the simulator just making the noise of the rocket engines, there was that, but then also obviously we just started moving up, and we never stopped going up. It just, you could tell that you were just shooting directly straight into the sky, and there was rumbling about the feeling of being on a roller coaster. And the most amazing thing about it was the three of us in the top of that capsule might have been the calmest people in the whole area at the time, because we knew what we were trained for, we knew what we were doing, and we knew, I think, in our hearts that we were about to kind of achieve this lifelong dream and get to contribute to this program that we love so much. So it was an awesome feeling. We were well prepared, and I just remember being so happy that it was actually happening and just feeling really, really well prepared, and like everything around me that was going on was a comfortable and familiar thing. It was amazing.
Making connections with space and surf. That was part of a discussion that took place this morning between world champion surfer Kelly Slater and orbiting astronaut Christina Koch. Just yesterday, Koch celebrated her 300th day in space. She spent more total time in space than any other woman. This year, NASA is counting down to commemorate 20 continuous years of humans in space aboard the International Space Station. And to hear the full chat, we will have links at hpr.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Oceanfront Beach Tree Restaurant at Four Seasons Resort Hualalai. Open daily for lunch and dinner, featuring Italian and Mediterranean cuisine with Californian and tropical influences using locally sourced ingredients.
Honolulu Civil Beats Reality Check today focus on changes at the Honolulu Police Commission. Reporter Yu Yun Jung joins us this morning. Hi there.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Yes, you had some drama at the commission meeting this week, huh?
That's correct. There's some leadership change. Loretta Sheehan is no longer the chair of the Honolulu Police Commission, and now Shannon Alivada, who used to be the vice chair, is the chair.
Now, there are folks that were pleased when Loretta stepped in because she was kind of questioning a lot of things that I think maybe some members on the commission hadn't in the past. And so some people are wondering about her future on the commission.
That's correct. So Loretta is a former federal prosecutor, and she led the commission through much of the federal corruption probe that swept through the department. So that's with the former police chief, Louis Kealoha, and his wife, former city prosecutor, Catherine Kealoha, at the center of much of it. You know, they of course, ended up getting convicted of conspiracy and obstruction charges, as well as pleading guilty to fraud charges. And Catherine Kailua pleaded guilty to additional federal felonies. And not only that, Louis Kailua enlisted HPD officers in the conspiracy. Two HPD officers were also found guilty as part of the federal conspiracy trial, and two other HPD officers pleaded guilty in the case earlier on. So Loretta was basically the only commissioner who wanted Chief Kailua fired when all the other commissioners wanted to approve a $250 retirement package.
Right, and she voted against that, the only one.
Yeah, she was the only one, and now she's no longer the chair.
Right, and now the city's talking about, what, trying to sue to get that money back.
Exactly.
So, gosh, I'm curious about, you know, how that meeting went down.
That's correct. The meeting was actually, Steve Levinson, who is another commissioner, nominated Sheehan to return as chair, saying the commission needs a chair that, you know, sometimes asks probing and unwelcome questions, because, you know, that's what Loretta Sheehan did, because the public expects the commission to know what's going on with the department. And part of what's going on with the department is not just showing up, it's asking tough questions. But, you know, Commissioner Kerry Okanaga nominated Shannon Alavado, saying the commission should be more forward-looking and move on from the past being what happened with Kealoha, and strive for greatness rather than dwelling on the past. And, you know, while she thought that Loretta Sheehan has done a great job helping rehabilitate the credibility of the department, she wanted leadership that focused on the future, and that was going to be Shannon.
Right, but we also recall when Mayor Caldwell made a statement about, you know, let's move on, and people said, not so fast. There are some serious issues here. We need to examine some of these problems and make sure we don't repeat them.
Exactly. So Commissioner Levinson actually said that he doesn't think they should move on from the past, and his exact quote was, I don't think time can ever really come when the commission can simply take on faith that all is well. And, you know, he and Loretta Sheehan both thought that, you know, it's not really time to move on from the past. There still needs to be a lot of questions asked, and they still need to be hyper-vigilant about public corruption.
So will Loretta Sheehan still remain on the commission?
So that's not quite clear at this point in time, because her term technically expired December 31st, 2019, and the mayor's office said that they either have to reappoint her or make another appointment, and they're going to do that soon, but they haven't clarified when that's going to be yet.
Okay, well, everybody will be watching. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was reporter Hugh Yun Jung with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org. This week, our HPR news team has been focused on trash and how each county deals with their Opala. We've been hearing from you about your relationship with garbage and the solutions you think would help us reduce Opala.
Hi, my name is Lisa Sekai Darcy. I'm calling from Maui County. I suggest the county reduce all trash pickups to once a week and require everyone to bring their trash personally to the landfill at least once a month. This might encourage neighbors to talk to one another and switch on and off and help recognize their own polluting contribution. And when you put trash in a bin and a truck takes it away, you own really no part of the trash burden. I can preach this because I totally changed my lifestyle to create minimal waste through purchasing through local markets, just plain doing without, unless I have my own utensils, hot and cold cups, etc., when I do take away.
Yeah, my name is John Olson, and I'm calling from the Big Island. I have followed the solid waste issues on both Oahu and on the Big Island here for the last 30 years. I think the fundamental problem with it is that the funding for the solid waste program comes almost entirely from property tax. there should be a disposal fee at the point of purchase. People should be able to be aware of what it costs to dispose of the items that they are purchasing. At this point, there is a total disconnect between what people pay and the information they're given about how the product that they are purchasing will come to a terminus.
Aloha, this is Jerry Ross from Kupa'a Farms in Maui. I was interested to hear your program on waste and trashing islands. For years now, we've been trying to get organic matter to go through a composting facility, to actually get one created here. Every day, 75 tons of food waste goes into that dump. That's part of the 600 and some odd pounds of trash on a daily basis. So if we could re-divert that to compost, we would be able to cover about 3,000 acres a year with compost on this island. We need to get the intent from our politicians to actually do that. Compost is not a dirty thing. It's a very positive way to treat organic matter. I hope the public is listening and we can get on this toot sweet. Aloha.
And Edward Johnson from the Big Island shared this. I have farmed portions of my land and live right by Alia Stream on the east side of Hawaii Island, north of Hilo, since 1989. Here's a partial list of plastic items that I have cleared out of the stream from upstream during past floods. Enormous sheets of pond liner, hundreds of plastic fertilizer bags, a kayak, hundreds of small plastic water bottles, tarps, many, many 2.5-gallon empty plastic Roundup containers, plastic buckets, weed mat, shade cloth, and large amounts of various PVC pipes and fittings. We have cleared out much, but often just see it pass by and can do nothing because when those streams flood, the water rages so much it is dangerous to try and get close. Thanks for the feedback. If you have comments or other thoughts to share, please email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line 972-8217.
Support for The Conversation comes from Matson, celebrating the first of four new ships designed and built for its Hawaii service, and supporting HPR1's news coverage from around the world. Matson.com.
This month, we're expecting an inspection team to pay a visit to Oahu to see how we're doing at the Honolulu Zoo. The city lost its accreditation in 2016 for the first time, and the staff has been working to correct any deficiencies to get that seal of approval back. Two big problems, lack of dedicated funding and a revolving door of zoo directors. Now, we invited former zoo director Ken Redman, who knows firsthand what the team will be looking for, since he's been tapped to do that for the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. He served as head of the Honolulu Zoo for 17 years. Accreditation, he tells us, used to be voluntary.
Now it is mandatory. Every 5 years, you must be inspected. And what AZA will send out, they'll send out three inspectors. One is a zoo director. In our case, zoo, it's not an aquarium. Zoo director, a veterinarian, and a general curator. A general curator is in charge of all the animal programs and all the zookeepers. So three people, and they will inspect the zoo very, very, I'll say it again, very thoroughly. On the commission, accreditation commission, there are 11 members and a chairman.
So the folks that will be coming this month are basically then, they're out in the field for like 1 or 2 days?
And oh, 2 days. For sure, 2 days. And our zoo has to pay all the expenses to fly them over here and to put them up, feed them, et cetera, et cetera. They are certainly a working group. Don't disturb them because they are going to work well into the evening and go on from there.
So they leave no stone unturned.
Yeah, Catherine, are your socks in your drawer in your bedroom nicely lined up?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. You pass.
Okay.
When they arrive, they're going to start right away. They're going to ask a lot of questions of not just our zoo director, but they may even want to meet with the city staff, city and county staff, the managing director, the head of our enterprise services, and the budget director. That's going to be the zoo director's job. He's going to do administration stuff, while the general curator is going to be meeting with our staff.
Right, and he's focused in on the welfare of the animals.
Correct. And the veterinarian, of course, is animal health. And he's going to be looking at the facilities for taking care of the animals. What are the records for taking care of your animals? Do you have necropsy reports? Necropsy is autopsies, mm-hmm. you know. And do you have facilities for quarantining animals and so forth and so on? So that's the veterinarian's job. You know, there were major problems from the inspection. Were they addressed? Please, yes, were they addressed? If not, deep kimchi. There's also going to be minor problems. Were they addressed? Now, going back, Catherine, we didn't make everything with us blue ribbon one time. We were tabled. We didn't pass inspection, but we were given 1 year to make improvements. And then I had to appear before the commission to demonstrate we did make those improvements, and then we passed.
Right, so, and with the situation with our current zoo director, she's been there. She was an animal, a bird keeper, I think. Hopefully, with her in the position as director, that will stave off that revolving door.
That for sure. She's a local. She's been in the zoo. She was there when I came. Mm-hmm. I came in 1991, and she was probably there from 1986, 1987, when she was a bird keeper, and then she came to a senior bird keeper. Then she went up to assistant zoo director and then director.
Right. So she's worked her way up, so she kind of knows the ropes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She knows animals.
Right.
You know, and working with zookeepers and the union, she knows that stuff. And she's pretty darn good at that. But there's also budget and, you know, all of that sort of stuff.
Talking about the animals now, as part of the whole plan for species survival plan.
Okay.
Talk about that, because that's one of the components, right, in conservation.
Exactly. It is a very, very important component. Let's go back one step here. There are taxonomic advisory groups. Okay. Let's say apes. That's a taxonomic advisory group. Cats, that's a taxonomic advisory group. And then from there, let's go to, I said just cats, there will be a CHEDA, SSP, Species Survival Plan. And the objective of a Species Survival Plan is to maintain 95% genetic variability in all the cheetahs in captivity. In other words, you don't want to have any inbreeding. You want to not inbreed your cheetahs.
We just got three girls.
Mm-hmm. Three girls.
Sisters, yes.
Yeah. And why? Because we have an empty exhibit. And cheetahs, you can find lions in a group, a pride of lions. You go to cheetahs are, you know, they're solitary. So as these girls, their sisters, get a little older, they're not going to get along. They're going to fight. So an SSP, Species Survival Plan, will decide this zoo over here needs to have this female cheetah. This zoo over there needs that female cheetah. Maybe our zoo can hold the one because she'll be by herself. But that's okay. She likes to be alone. But an SSP program will then say he is not related to the female cheetah in Honolulu and will send that male to Honolulu, and we hope they will have babies.
Right.
They
so it'll be matchmaking.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Right. They don't breed well in captivity, but, you know, you give it a shot.
Right, right.
You hope they will breed. And so the same story on the other two females we have. They will go to other zoos and make sure, as best as we can, that they're not distantly related.
Okay. So somebody's got this database mapped out.
Well, we don't call it a database. We call it a stud book.
Okay. All right. A stud book.
Now, the cheetah population in our zoos right now, in AZA zoos, are so closely related, you can do a skin graft on a cheetah and it takes on another. They're too darned closely related.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, one of my favorite exhibits at the zoo is the chimps.
At the Sedgwick County Zoo, where I was at before, we had a number of chimps. And one of the chimps had a baby. And she didn't know how to raise it. We got a baby incubator from the hospital. And she was hypothermic. She was, you know, she was cold. She was dehydrated. And our veterinarian got her up to speed, got a little baby bottle for her, you know, for formula. And then my wife worked in a hospital at that time. She was a medical technologist. So I called up Evelyn, my wife, and said, guess what? You're going to have a little baby when you get home. And she raised the baby. I named it Binti. It means daughter in Swahili. We had Binti for about a year. And then it was determined that she was a chimpanzee, not a little human baby. So it was determined that we should send her to the Cleveland Zoo, where they were hand-raising a boy as well. Not related,
right.
Not related, but hand-raising a little boy that had been abandoned as well. Binti, as far as I know, went after that, as she got a little older, went to the Knoxville Zoo. SSP program, where she would be mated with an unrelated chimp. You'd have no real option to move your animals. You are obligated to
follow the rules.
Follow the rules, yeah.
So that is part of the whole plan that this inspection team will be looking at as they visit.
Are you involved? How many SSPs are you involved in to start with? Major importance is animals' escape plan. In our cheetah exhibit, we let them out the first time when we had a brand new cheetah exhibit. They were rambunctious and they were running all over the exhibit, and one of them came to the wall. Well, the book says cheetahs cannot jump higher than 8 feet. Wrong.
Interesting.
That was the cheetah never read that book. And she got up, front feet up, and managed to scramble on the top. And they're wide open to that area. And there's this lady with her youngster in a stroller. Wow, this is a really great zoo. You can see the animal right in front of you.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
But we had an animal escape plan.
Close call.
And what do you do? You sound the alarm. You escort all your visitors to safe areas, and then cheetahs are very, very mild, and you just shush them over to the exhibit.
Thank heavens, cheetahs are mellow creatures. That was Honolulu Zoo Director Ken Redman talking about a close call with an escaped cheetah at our zoo. Redman, who spends his retirement years leading tours in Africa, has lots and lots of interesting animal stories to share. As for the accreditation, the commission will likely make its decision in April.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Locations, Haleakala Waldorf School, and Honolulu Waldorf School.
Finally today, in our Mauka Makai segment, we learn about the tradition of lei making and the city's Lei Day celebrations. The city's Lady of Lei, Kaulani Vincent Kawahi, was kind enough to share the mana behind this tradition. She was joined by the current Lei Queen, Nicole Nakamatsu. The city's just announced it's extending the deadline for those interested in vying to be part of the 2020 Lei Court until next Friday, January 17th. But first, Kaiulani lays out the history of Lei Day festivities and the story behind this year's theme, Lei of Special Places.
So what we started last year, we had a theme for 4 years, and we're looking at the Ahupua'a, and from land, from the ocean, all the way up to the mountains. And so each year we're picking a plant from those different areas. So last year was Pohinahina, the ocean seashore side. So this year is Le'ili, and the theme material is ki, or tea leaf. And then next year it'll be the forest area with A'ali'i, and the year after that will be the mountain area, and it'll be Ohi'alehua. So we are keeping that rod in mind, and what we may do is actually substitute flowers that'll end up still looking with the lei that it'll look like a Ohi'ale, but it won't have any Ohi'a in it.
Yes. Okay, but you want that to be predominantly the theme, though, right?
Correct.
Each year, from
Correct.
Year to year. And yes. So if there are folks out there that are interested in participating over the next couple of years, maybe they need to hurry up and start planting.
And, you know, our website has a lot of information. And that is exactly why we put the themes out in, like, four-year chunks, is so people can plan their gardens as each year of lei making.
Okay. And so as we prepare then for this next year, part of the big Lei Day celebration is obviously the Lei Court. And this morning we're also joined by our current Lei Queen, Nicole Nakamatsu. How did you get involved? Well, you know, why did you decide to throw your hat in the ring here?
Yeah, well, actually, my mom was on the Lei Court in 2007. So since then, I've kind of had an idea, or maybe kind of like a little dream, that maybe one day I would step into that role and maybe apply or compete to become the Lei Queen. And this past year, that's what I did. And so I'm very lucky that I have the opportunity to represent Hawaii in this role.
So were you hanging out with your mom at some of these meetings and going
yeah.
to mm-hmm. all the preparations?
Exactly. In all of these meetings, I would actually at home, we would also practice her lei making. So even then, I was kind of being groomed for the position.
And so what kind of lei did you make?
For the contest, I actually had a whole bunch of different flowers. The idea in mind for my lei was a lei of a whole bunch of different flowers and colors, because to me, a lei is something that is kind of like a symbol of our culture here in Hawaii. We are made up of so many different backgrounds and different people. So I wanted my lei to really showcase that. So I had different flowers, different colors, different textures. And then it all just came together into something really beautiful.
So talk about the process in putting the lei court together.
It's year-round planning for us. And for us at Parks, we actually kind of like getting to really get to know the court. So there's an application process, and then at the day of the event, there's a small opening, and then each of the contestants has 1 hour to make a lei wili. And so at the same time, they're being judged. So the judges come and sit and talk with them. So now they have to be able to focus, make lei, and still be able to speak with people coming by.
Multitasking.
It really is multitasking, because you have the judges there and you have the people who actually came to see the event also here and there going, oh, what flower is that you're using? So they're really distracted. So they have, you know, they have to focus and still be cordial to people. And then they have to speak in English and Hawaiian. So they're not expected to be native speakers, but we really emphasize that they at least be able to pronounce the Hawaiian language correctly, because they will be expected to speak in public at some engagements. We take a short break, and then they come back and they show their hula skills off. And then after that, the judging scores come out, and we find out who our new court is.
I'm sure, Nicole, you're going to be sorry to see this year end.
Yes, very much so. I had so much fun this year.
Talk about some of the things that you were able to get involved in.
Mm-hmm. So I've actually been able to participate in a lot of the local parades with my princess, Brittany Corpuz. We've been able to be part of different events, such as there's an event at the Kuakini home, where it's Adopt a Mom, and basically it's an opportunity for us to spend time with people who are living in the Kuakini home system that are not able to spend time with their families. Maybe their families are away abroad or on the neighbor islands. So that was something that was really special to me.
That is really, it's a neat idea.
Yeah.
What a wonderful concept to be able to go into places like this and bring joy.
Exactly. And that's just one of the many opportunities I've had.
And so, Nicole, would you have any advice to someone who might be on the fence or, you know, maybe didn't have the opportunities that you had to kind of get an idea of what's involved, but to encourage someone to, you know, just take part?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just such an amazing opportunity to be part of the selection process because you have the opportunity to prepare yourself in ways that I really didn't have the opportunity to, I feel, experience prior to preparation for the event, for the selection. So I've actually been able to meet with my kumus, and they've been able to help me through the Hawaiian language portion and talking to me a little bit about the different flowers that I would use or help me brainstorm ideas for what I wanted to create in my lei. And so even if you are on the fence, like I was on the fence as well, but I feel that it's just an opportunity, you know, allow yourself to experience the opportunity of putting yourself out there, experiencing different things, allowing yourself to experience opportunities that will maybe prepare you for the selection process that I wouldn't have had if I'd even try. I would just say, go for it. Honestly, go for it, because that's what I did, and I had the amazing opportunity of being this past year's lay queen.
So do you have to be part of a halau to participate?
No, you don't. No. Because I know there's a lot of people out there that may have been dancing from when they were really small, you know, from learning from family and everything, and you don't need to be part of a halau. Yeah.
Now, I remember a friend of mine was part of the queens, the pa'u unit, for the King Kamehameha Day parade, and it was fun to go down, and we were at Waikiki Elementary, and we were, you know, making the lei for the horses, and that was a really fun experience, and it was just nice to see people from the community just come out to support the group. You know, it's a wonderful cultural experience.
It is, and so we, you know, when we work with the contestants even before the selection, and, you know, we work with them. We want them to have a really rich, rewarding experience. And a lot of them actually get kind of close with each other. They know they're competing against each other, but they're there. They support one another. I see them clapping for each other, you know, after one is given a speech and everything. And then that experience throughout the year. So we even have some of the contestants who ended up not being selected. They come to Lei Day to support those who were selected. And they, you know, so it really, we want it to become really family. And then right now it's a sisterhood of lay queens and lay princesses. And when we have events, we call them out and boom, they're right there to support.
It is a wonderful day, a wonderful tradition. And I just love just the intricacy of, and the artistry of these lei, you know, when the lei makers come and they compete and they present their finest, and then you go see, you know, what the judges have picked. I mean, that's such an amazing experience.
It is quite stunning to see. And so we're very fortunate because when we go, we can get up close and personal with the lei as they're hanging on the display board. And we start to, over the years, we get to know even the lei makers quite personally. So, you know, we end up, we're sending each other's Christmas cards. We feel free to call one another if we have a question about a lei material and how best to use it and what temperature even to keep they keep separate refrigerators. That's how, they're intense. They keep separate refrigerators at a specific temperature that's not cold enough to maintain food, but perfect for flowers.
Oh, interesting.
I know. So it's a science for them. They pick plants, they see how long it lasts, how to best keep it. So it's, you know, our lay queens learn that as well. And then they come and they help us do lay making workshops for our park staff, as well as even lay making workshops for the public prior to Lei Day. So it's very supportive.
And now with this year's theme of the tea leaf, How does that work? I mean, as far as the different types of things that you could bring in and incorporate? Because I guess most people think, oh, tea leaf, it's kind of a base.
Correct. Our theme lids, as long as they use that material that it can be easily seen in the theme lay, so this year it must be tea leaf. So there's other categories that are go by color. And there's a neck lay, there's a lay papale, which is the hat lay. There's a category for beginners, and then it's the theme lay, which must mandatory to use whatever that theme material is for that current year.
It's always interesting to me when I go to an event and I see someone with an unusual lay, and it's like, oh, you know, they've got maybe magnolia leaves somehow arranged in an unusual way. Or I just discovered this past year, the miniature crown flower, which was fascinating. Yes. You know, and that dries so nicely. And I think that's what I like about lay. Is that, you know, it's wonderful when it's fresh and the colors are so vibrant, but then when they dry out, some of them are just really spectacular.
They really are, yeah. It just really shows the artistry of the lei makers.
And so do you have your lei from last year?
I think I still do. Yeah, I think it's actually probably in our family's armoire. We like to keep certain things that are really important to our family, and that's definitely one. So we do still have it.
I have a friend who has a lei graveyard in her backyard, you know, and I don't know if many people do that, but you do have, you know, wonderful lei that you're gifted and you know, you hang on to that memory with it, your graduation or your child's graduation, you know, with the mylei, and then you just drape it, you know, in the house.
But mm-hmm. And let it dry out, and then it's part of your family forever, right?
Yes. Yes.
So ours is the piano at home.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, ours is the piano at home, and we have, like, these little dishes, that special lei that people have given us, mm-hmm. and we'll put it in there because we know if we pick it up, it might start to just, yep. You know. And then also the graveyard in the back is because you don't just throw them away, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, it goes back to the land.
Full circle, back to the aina. That was City Parks Culture and Arts Coordinator Ka'iulani Vincent Kawahi and Lei Day Queen Nicole Nakamatsu in our Mauka to Makai segment. We were talking about the traditions around lei and lei day. Do you have what it takes to be part of the lei court? There are different age groups from 18 to 61 and above. Try it. You never know. Head to our website for links. And I should note that this is the 93rd year of the Lei Day festivities and the 80th year for the lei court. That wraps it up for this Friday. Coming up next week, our newsroom continues its look at trash, but this time with stories about recycling. Got a recycling story to share? Call or talk back line. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or find links to information, go to our webpage, hawaiipublicradio.org. This program is produced by Lillian Song, Harrison Patino, and Jason Ubai, and Pedro Kimura. The backyard theme, thanks to John DeMello, and our jazzy theme music performed by Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.